Principle number 3. A sound therapeutic relationship. Of course, the client must talk openly about fears and anxiety for the therapeutic process to occur. As you know, clients often avoid talking about their fears. So this very obvious factor of a sound therapeutic relationship is even more of a challenge for the anxiety disordered client. One client exclaimed, "If I talk about my anxiety, that will make me feel anxious. I don't want to take the chance." If you know a major part of treatment consists of encouraging the client to face frightening situations so as to be able to view them realistically, and talking about them is one way of reaching the client's goals. To build this sound relationship, I find especially with the anxiety disorder client, I have to be acutely aware of possible misinterpretations and misunderstandings of my interventions. I recall in one session, I used humor and the "so what if" technique. That is to hypothesize the worst possibility, an approach that appeared helpful to the client. At the end of the session, I ask a standard feedback question. "Was there anything about the session that bothered you?" The client responded, "You seem to be making fun of me and not taking my concerns very seriously." This feedback enabled me to correct this misconception immediately. Therefore, in building a trusting relationship with an anxiety disordered client, I find it extremely helpful to have a basic ask for feedback question towards the end of the session. "Was there anything about this session that bothered you?" Principle 4. Therapy is a collaborative effort. With an anxiety disordered client, there's a little difference here. The emphasis is on working on problems rather than on correcting defects or changing personality. The therapist fosters the attitude two heads are better than one in approaching difficulties. When the client is so entangled in symptoms that he or she is unable to join in problem solving, I find I may have to assume a leadership role as therapy progresses to encourage the client to take more of an active role. So the key here with principle number 4 is it's important to have a collaborative effort that we're solving problems. However, with an anxiety disordered client, I found, like you, that at times you need to take more of a leadership role if they seem totally entangled in various issues. Principle number 5. Cognitive therapy uses questions. I find I am modeling coping strategies by asking questions that expand my client's constructive thinking. Often a client reports that when confronted by a new anxiety-producing situation, he or she will still start by asking himself the same questions he heard in a therapy session. Some of these questions are, and you might compare them with yours, "Where's the evidence? Where's the logic? What do I have to lose? What do I have to gain? What will be the worst thing that could happen? What can I learn from this experience?" Principle number 6. Cognitive therapy is structured and directive. Anxious clients, as you know, tend to go off on tangents, as mentioned earlier. I can model task-oriented behavior by keeping the discussion on the problem at hand. Also, I find that I have to set the appropriate tempo for the session. Think of an anxiety disordered client that you're currently treating or have treated in the past, and think about who set the tempo for the session. If the pace is too fast, your client may miss much of what is being discussed, and if it's too slow, he or she may lose confidence in reaching their end result. I find a key with the structure of the session is to look for a common ground or an earlier causal link. With one client, Phil, he was afraid of strangers, his boss, and his parents. The common denominator was fear of rejection. Such reductions to a common ground make the problem more manageable. Sue had a fear of elevators that prevented her from looking for a job, and her joblessness caused even more difficulties for her. Dealing with the first problem, elevator phobia, solved her other problems. Bill had many fears of starting a new job. These are some of the things he said. people won't like me. I won't be able to do the job. I don't think that I'll like the people. All of which could be traced back to the common ground of the basic fear that his bosses would discover he had exaggerated on his job application. So in principle number 6, look for a common denominator or common ground or earlier link. Principle number 7. Cognitive therapy is, of course, problem-oriented. The key technique here to keeping the session problem-oriented is the actual conceptualization of the problem definition. As you know, in conceptualizing a client's problem, the therapist has to elicit from the client what the problem means to him or her. Now, the passive-aggressive person may be procrastinating because he believes this is the way to avoid being controlled by others. The anxious client, the depressed client, the angry client, and the manic client will all have different reasons, of course. Procrastination may indicate a shift of priorities that the client has not fully accepted, or it may be due to secondary gains, such as a way to get attention, or rationalizations. For example, one client said, "I could be a great painter, but I don't have the self-discipline." The point is that there are many reasons a client may be procrastinating, as you know. You and your client need to conceptualize the problem jointly before an adequate strategy can be chosen. And I realize this is a rather basic point, but I find that I oftentimes overlook the basics in a session of a wrong conceptualization of the problem. Conceptualization, strategy selection, and technique implementation influence and feed each other. Usually this process is, of course, as you know, an evolving one of conceptualizing and reconceptualizing and reconceptualizing with cooperation and communication of strategies with the client. Question number 2. To effectively deal with conceptualizing, the therapist has to elicit what from the client?